Carrie Cassidy, Project Camelot, Whistleblower Radio, and very happy to be here tonight. Let's see, I've got a very interesting guest. I know about him as much about him as you do, whereas most of the time I know something more about my guests. But in this case, I will give you a taste of his bio, but I'm going to let him really do the talking about who he is. He's written a very interesting book, and I'm in the process of reading it right now, so I'm fascinated to see what it is that has propelled him along this path to write this book. And then we're going to talk about actually, you know, just how real it really is, and so on. So we'll go down in that direction. Just in terms of announcements, I have a new article on my blog that I think people should take a look at in terms of the White Hats and their recent report and a couple of my comments about where that is all headed. Very interesting, situation in terms of Pure Heart, the investment company, and the trail that is basically leading to Black projects. And the funding stream for Black projects. So that's something to take a look at and to also just be very aware of going forward with regard to the White Hats. So let's see if there's anything else. I do have a new interview for people that aren't familiar and haven't been following. And if you haven't signed up for our newsletter, I'd like to encourage you to do so. It is free, and you just you can find it very easily. I think it's linked on the front page. I haven't looked lately, but usually it's on the right hand side. If you just scroll down, there should be a link to sign up for the newsletter. So if you do that, you will get a newsletter that gives you updates on our events when we do a live stream event. And we should be doing one in the very near future on Project Bluebeam. I'm actually putting that together right now, and hoping to get some very good speakers on that event. That will be an online live event, and we'll go more into that as time moves on. If you do decide to become a member of Project Camelot, you will help to support our work, and it costs me money to run the website and to stay, obviously pay my rent and continue my investigations, as well as bringing you cutting edge stories on a weekly basis, actually on a daily basis, more like it. And my most recent interview with Norm Bergram, Ringmakers of Saturn, is absolutely cutting edge information, and you should not miss that. He is 91 years old and had way above top secret clearances in an organization that was a precursor. Well, first of all, he worked for a precursor to NASA, which is called NACA, and then his way above top secret clearance was with Lockheed, and that was Lockheed before it became Lockheed Martin. So we're talking about somebody who really was read in on everything, and he is saying, just to cut to the chase, that those vehicles that are in the rings of Saturn that he's been talking about and writing a book about, that they are now on their way here. What that means for us is, anybody's guess, but you know, it's certainly a line of research and inquiry that should be followed and pursued, and this is something that you can get sort of the basis for if you listen to my interview with Norm Bergman, and that's just like a week or two old. So without further ado, David E. Martin, he's written a book. It's got a new title. It used to be called Coupe de 12, I see, and it is now called Apostles of Power, Theft of an Empire. And it just basically, it's got a short bio here. I'll just read it. David E. Martin, U.S. Congressional and EU Parliamentary Policy Advisor in Global Finance and Ethics, came to an international notoriety for his data analysis in his disclosure prior to the global financial crisis of 2008. His real-life insight and witness to corruption in the highest places has given way to a novel about the truth that befalls us. In a world where people have control in only the most mundane daily decisions, there are those manipulating nations at the highest levels. They are the thieves of empires and emperors of the world. That's on the cover of the book. And I guess that's more or less his standard bio. It's rather short, but I'm going to let him kind of go into more depth. And he's also runs this organization I'm very curious about, so I'm going to ask him about that as well, called MCAN Inc., I believe. And that's MCAM, so it's MCAM Inc., and I guess it's m-cam.com. David, are you there?
I am indeed, Carrie. How are you?
Hi, I'm fine. Very, very nice to talk to you. I am reading your book, as I mentioned, off the air, and finding it fascinating. And you've got quite a grasp of people in high places, because you're pretty accurate in terms of, I guess, just some of your inside dialogue and sort of the grasp of places they would go, things they would do, and how they interact.
Well, it's always a fascinating situation where, for over two decades, beginning with work that we did back in the late 1980s and early 1990s, in understanding how governments both financed and enforced their various activities, it was very interesting to have a number of people throughout the last two decades say that when they would sit and talk after about an hour conversation, it was inevitable that somebody would say, "You ought to write a book about your last week of experiences, because nobody would ever believe it. It would be an amazing novel." And having heard that for nearly two decades, I finally decided that, truth has always been stranger than fiction. So you might as well go down the pathway of writing the most unbelievable story, which happens to be the one that you get to live. And that's how the book came about. So it was actually quite a bit of fun to go through a process of laying out a series of events that begin in the mid to late 1990s and set the actual events to a fictional thread. And the rest is history. It's been a phenomenal success, and it's been a delight to actually see how people are beginning to go back through the book, start to follow the trails of breadcrumbs that are left there, and find out information that has been conveniently overlooked for, in many cases, over a decade, which give a great deal of explanation to exactly what has been happening and how the public has been misled in, essentially how the world generally, and more specifically how certain numbers of individuals on an individual basis have really co-opted all systems for their own gain at the great expense of the rest of humanity. And that's something that obviously we care deeply about and would like to see interdicted.
Okay. Well, let me sort of back you up a bit and get you to talk something more about your background before we get into the book. And I definitely want to go there. So could you describe a little bit about your business background, your education, and if you can also, I'm going to be asking you where your sources of information come from. So yeah, if you want to wrap something along those lines in there as well, that'd be great.
Indeed. Well, beginning in the late 1980s, going into the early 1990s, I was particularly intrigued by a thread that actually began when I was in Central America during the end of the Nicaraguan War. I had gone down as part of my undergraduate studies to Costa Rica to work in the refugee and triage clinic, which was on the border between Costa Rica and Nicaragua. And I had a very interesting series of events where, during the time I was down there, which was towards the end of the actual conflict period, in addition to working in the triage clinic where I was working with the Costa Rican Ministry of Health, I had the opportunity to interact with a number of government agents from the United States who worked with the CIA, the DEA, and other organizations. And I had a very interesting series of interactions. And as you'll recall, and as your listeners will recall, this was just as the beginnings of Iran-Contra had started percolating through the system. I was fascinated to find out that many of the people who the DEA and the CIA were both allegedly looking for operated very much in plain sight, not far from where I was stationed and where I was working. And I was amazed to see that hundreds of people who were allegedly looking for these ultra arch criminals that were sending drugs up to the U.S. Were somehow missing the fact that several of the drug lords who were allegedly too nefarious to be found were very frequently out in front of their homes washing their SUVs and hanging out, and I got to see them quite easily, so I couldn't imagine why hundreds of people looking for them couldn't find them. And I had the opportunity to meet with a group of folks on one weekend where I was informed that the reason why we couldn't find them is because we really weren't trying to find them. As a matter of fact, they were good for business, because it turns out that for many years, for over five decades, the drug cartels have played a very important role in funding a series of government operations that need to have cash moved expediently without having a great deal of attention drawn to them. And that the drug wars that we hear about all over the media are in fact just convenient ways to hide very significant financial transactions. That thread, which was laid down in the mid and late 1980s, was something that I didn't ever drop. And when I began working with treaty-restricted technology transfer in the early 1990s, it became very interesting to see the intersection between restrictions that were laid down at the end of the Second World War, which limited the import and export of sensitive technologies, and a number of very interesting financial transactions that seemed not to ever get much public scrutiny. And that began a series of inquiries using some fairly complex unstructured data analysis technologies that we had developed at the same time. We started tracking both transactions and transacting parties where improbable alliances started showing up. And so through the period of time that was the birth of my first corporation, Mosaic Technologies, ultimately the company that spun out the company I'm currently chairman of, MCAM, we actually maintained a very active monitoring system on both transacting parties and their transactions to try to understand why it was that so many people were seemingly operating in near plain sight, but getting no attention in any conventional media, no accountability anyplace. And over the last, two decades, we have maintained a very active vigilance, and we have made a significant commitment to make sure that the deeds done in opaque sight are disclosed in the appropriate fashions when and if there are people who are able to actually take action to interdict the behavior of public officials acting for their personal interest rather than for the public interest.
Okay, so you've been tracing technology. So are you a lawyer?
No, actually, I did study the law when I was working on my doctorate at the University of Virginia. I have published in law journals, but I have actually done the best of all worlds. I've actually studied the law, but not had to ever sit for the bar exam. So what we have done is actually monitored commercial transactions. We do a significant amount of work to deal with our core business inside of MCAM is to help provide capital access to small emerging businesses who have been overlooked as part of the broader infrastructure of how the economic system is supposed to work, which it hasn't been working for quite some time. And we do a lot of work across now 140 some odd countries where we are directly involved in trying to both initiate ethical capital flows, as well as bringing greater transparency to the capital markets generally.
Okay. Well, fascinating. And as far as your background in finance, do you have any degrees in or study in this area? I mean, how did you get in that sort of, you appear to have a lot of expertise in that area.
Yeah, I learned that I was an economist about 20 years after I was doing things in economics. So that was kind of fascinating. I actually have had that label put on me many times, and I'm never sure whether I should actually embrace it or not. I think what a lot of people make the mistake of is they look at what we do in terms of understanding the capital markets, how money flows, how money is manipulated, and how financial policies are controlled and manipulated, and they think that that makes you an economist. In fact, what we do is more forensic investigation than anything else. What ultimately threw us into a fairly significant both domestic and international spotlight are the events leading up to the banking collapse in Japan in 1998, where we became very involved in helping to manage those issues for a number of entities around the world. And then in 2006, as a member of the Arlington Institute Board of Directors, I gave a very famous speech where I laid out the facts leading up to and including the collapse that took place in 2008. And I made the mistake in subsequent both written documents as well as public speeches where I laid out the order of bank failures 2 years before they happened. And when you do that, people think that that means you're an economist. In fact, what it means is you're looking at things that are available to be looked at that nobody else is paying attention to. So people use that moniker, but in fact, what we do is understand the capital systems globally, probably more comprehensively than anybody else. We certainly have a greater accuracy than anybody who has the economist name attached to them. And we have a bad habit of continuing to be a very significant and typically a rather contrarian voice in the capital markets. And for better or for worse, we happen to be pretty accurate in those calls.
Well, yes, a very interesting background, and I can see where that would lend itself very much to the book that you've written. Okay, so at this point, do you want to describe maybe the overall plot and why you went down the road you did in terms of the plot?
Certainly.
And then I'm also curious. I think it was you that got a hold of me, but it might have. Or actually, was I connected with you through a friend?
No,
That's what I'm
it
trying
was
to figure.
a gentleman who met me in an airport actually several months ago who actually put the two of us in touch.
Okay, very interesting. Okay, that's fine. So yeah, if you could talk about the plot of the book, so that people that who aren't familiar with it and haven't read it like or started to read it like I am, will have an idea where this is all leading.
Indeed. So the plot actually begins in an actual meeting that took place in New York City, where an individual gathered a group of what he referred to as shareholders to a meeting in New York to which I was invited. And the meeting was called to discuss a business plan, and the business plan was a business plan that was called President 2008. The business plan included an opportunity for up to 12 shareholders to buy equity in the purchasing of the presidency in 2008. The idea was actually rather simple, that there would be an effort that would be undertaken beginning in the 2000-2001 time period, which would begin a process of setting the stage for a fait accompli where a candidate that would be market tested and that would be appropriately marketed and vetted would actually be run, as well as appropriately testing and vetting the counter ticket, which would also be run by private investors who would ultimately have as their payoff the ability to move very significant amounts of the U.S. capital, and by that I mean money, into the hands of private investors and out of the hands of the public. That business plan was proposed, it was funded, and it was executed. And the nature of the book is actually following the arc of the events that took place from that first meeting forward, where a series of events were planned and executed that were referred to as a distraction, which included a number of events to set the stage for a erosion of both civil liberties as well as an erosion of the public's interest in believing that they had any ability to have an influence in the events that were surrounding them, including the very interesting, separated by only 1 week, double terror attacks in September of 2001, which, as you and your listeners will recall, have mysteriously been erased in half of their occurrence. Quite mysteriously, the September 8th terror attacks, which actually had a much greater impact across the nation in terms of generating fear, the anthrax scare of beginning September 18th and going through October 9th of 2001, has largely been forgotten. But those two events, September 11th and September 18th, were both part of a plan to begin the unraveling of the social fabric, which would lay the ground for a whole host of other actions, including the establishment of the enterprises of a very intrusionist state that set up a series of concessions where the government was able to move with impunity on very large amounts of capital and be able to move great deals of capital without any real accountability, both through intelligence and defense procurements and through a series of U.S. contractors and allied contractors move considerable wealth at much greater ease than was first thought. And it ultimately led to some very interesting things, which in fact are detailed in the final arc of the book, which is as the shareholders who thought that to achieve their objective, they needed to purchase the presidency, they actually realized that during the second Bush administration, their plan was already paying off far better than they expected. And one of the pieces of the book, which a lot of readers will find interesting, is that the final execution of the final plan, which involves a series of computer compromises that ultimately have a great risk of putting both the United States and several of the G20 into significant and long duration economic impairment, actually also happened to come into being about 2.5 months after the book was written, where we actually forecast the events that closed down the nuclear reactor at Lake Anna, which had direct implications, as the readers of the book will find out, to ultimately the stability of the financial records of the United States, both the official records as well as the unofficial records, which I won't spoil the end of the book.
But okay, no, please don't. Okay, but this is very interesting. So what you're saying is the book is based on fact.
Everything in the book actually happened, and everything in the book actually is a component of what I would refer to as the trail of breadcrumbs. I did, because of the fact that all of these events, as the media that has attempted to report certain ones of these things have found out as they've gone down the pathway of trying to report, ultimately get into some fairly interesting denials and ultimately threats, which have kept a number of these stories from actually getting fully investigated. My favorite one, obviously, you'll read about if you haven't already, which is the Olympic security money laundering exercise in Greece in 2004. One of the more fascinating ways in which an enormous amount of money was moved to sponsor both sides of the military exercises that have occupied the last decade. One of the things that became very fascinating in that scenario was we followed the money that came out of an investigation that has only been done partially by Vanity Fair, oddly enough, several years ago, where they looked at the very interesting accounting problems that were accounting problems associated with the public offering of SAIC, the company based in San Diego, where there was an inquiry into some mysterious billings of the company. And Vanity Fair got to the place where if they would have gone the next question further, they would have actually had a really interesting report. They got as close as anybody's ever gotten, and nobody got any closer. But those kinds of things, which are also in the book, are stories that deserve a great deal more inquiry, and one day they will actually get the inquiry they deserve, which is part of the reason why we put the trail of breadcrumbs down.
Okay, well, SAIC is definitely one of the cover organizations for Black Project money. And just out of curiosity, are you aware of the Black Projects? Because I don't know that you're mentioning that anywhere in the book, at least so far where I'm at.
Well, remember that there is an enormous number of projects that are officially kind of off the book projects, which are what some people refer to as Black Projects. You have to be aware that there is a significant number of projects.
Hi there. This is Carrie Cassidy, Project Camelot, Whistleblower Radio. And David, we were about to get the rest of your answer to a question that I asked you about Black Projects, and you were sort of going into an explanation of, to sum up from what I was hearing was you were basically saying Black Projects encompass a lot more than most maybe people customarily may think it encompasses. Although, there's no reason why Black Projects should have any limits, actually, if you think about it conceptually. It could go in any direction, and certainly finances is one of the directions. But do you want to continue just to round out your comments on that subject?
Yeah, I think that it's important to realize that there are an enormous number of projects that get done where the official cover story of what's going on and what actually is happening don't match. And I would say that any project where the public is being lied to, it kind of doesn't matter to me whether the lie is considered to be something which is relatively innocuous or whether it is absolutely horrific. At the end of the day, it's still an untruth. It's still a lie. And how you sugarcoat it doesn't much matter from my perspective. So when people talk about Black Projects, I look at a world filled with situations where if you look, and we were speaking about SAIC before the break, you look at the fact that they received over $100 million from the FBI back in 2001 to create what was supposed to be called the virtual case file. Very interestingly enough, what that was supposed to do was integrate intelligence data in June of 2001. And quite mysteriously, as anybody who has looked at that particular story, including congressional inquiries into it, SAIC wound up getting paid $100 million or more to create something that never was delivered and never worked. They allegedly created 700,000 lines of code. That 700,000 lines of code never was able to operate, and somehow or another they were able to wind up with a significant amount of cash left in their pocket, much like several other situations where that company has wound up being able to not only receive significant contracts that don't have deliveries associated with them, but when very public inquiries go on in terms of trying to figure out why something didn't work, the company is able to move forward using that cover story as a means to deploying capital in a number of different ways. The fact of the matter is, are those Black Projects? Are those a hijacking of public funds? Are they a collusion? what they wind up being, the name really doesn't matter. What matters is that the public is being defrauded in the name of its interest by organizations that have every intent to actually manipulate, control, and in this case, take funds from the public and misappropriate them into the private interests of a few.
Yes, absolutely. Just out of curiosity, and you know, I don't want to go too far off the beaten path here because I'd like to kind of get back to the to the central subject. But just because of some comments you made, have you been following Stuxnet at all?
Yes, indeed.
Okay. Very interesting. Okay. Well, maybe we can come around to discussing that a bit a little later. Let's circle back to the story. And so what we've established is that you, for some reason, feel that you had access to information that gave you the basis for the writing of this book. Is that correct?
Well, not only did I feel I had access to the information, one of the things that our organization does is actually compile information that is used by a whole host of enterprises of a variety of types. We don't actually feel like we have it. We actually have the raw files. We've had a number of situations where the nature of the information that we have happens to be a very desired piece of information, and in certain instances, for example, if we go back to the anthrax scare that took place in September of 2001, we were very involved in supplying information that led ultimately to the successful management of Bayer's demands to get a significant amount of money from the U.S. government to actually manage the distribution of ciprofloxacin, the drug that's used to treat anthrax. But we also, in the process of doing that, assisted in pointing out that in August 31st of 2000, quite interestingly enough, the U.S. Army data on inhaled anthrax was approved so that Cipro could be approved for inhalation anthrax. And that was August 31st of 2000 when that U.S. Army data was used for clinical trial approval of inhalation anthrax treatment. Quite ironically, shortly after that and going into the spring of 2001, the U.S. Army wound up purchasing an enormous amount of ciprofloxacin for the treatment of inhalation anthrax, and this obviously months before there was any reason to believe that there was any reason to have an anthrax issue anywhere. Those types of information are not things that we speculate. Those are raw data feeds that we wind up picking up from financial data and data transactions that happen all over the world. And those things are sourced in our organization.
Okay. So what you do is let me sort of reiterate that and see if this checks out with you. What you do is you do sort of a forensic analysis from a financial point of view of where the money is going and follow the money. And basically that leads you down a trail. And then you get certain evidence that goes along with that that information. But there are a lot of levels to information, as you can appreciate. And you can get to a certain place and think that you have, for example, an answer, and then you find that the answer is even further down the road. And I noticed, for example, and I'm not as familiar with the ins and outs of the medical, you know, what you're saying is the Army basically was preparing for anthrax scare, even though that, I mean, in a certain way, it seems to me that the anthrax situation was kind of a non-starter. And that it didn't really go anywhere. I mean, it might have seemed to go somewhere for the people that had to vacate their offices.
As a matter of fact, it became one of the largest wealth transfers that took place out of the entirety of the events of 2001. And that's the problem. And that's the point of this. I think what you...
Okay. Well, I guess, yeah, you're talking money. And that's interesting. That's fascinating, in
fact.
But
the fact is that the conventional attention both paid by conventional media and on to be the towers and the planes and the, everything else. While that was going on, the real theft was happening right under our noses, and nobody was paying attention.
Well, what about the money in the bottom of the Trade Center, for example? I mean, it seems to me there was more money in the gold that disappeared out of there as well.
Now, it pales in comparison with how much money was made on what were allegedly postal sniffers, vaccine development, the ability to inspect luggage and cargo, the intrusion into civil liberties all around the world. There were a lot of people that made a heck of a lot more money than the gold in the bottom of a tower.
Okay. Well,
that is fundamentally where the issues with respect to understanding that this distraction that took place in September of 2001 was carefully orchestrated for precisely the effect it had, which is to get people focused on the fire and the smoke and pay no attention to where the real heat was happening. The amount of funds that were transferred, that have been transferred since September of 2001, that have never received a shred of public scrutiny, far and away dwarf the amounts of money that were discussed with respect to the actual assets that were part of the September 11th event.
Okay. I'll take your word for that. Now, just out of curiosity, assuming that you have this trail of evidence in your possession,
yep.
Do you publish that somewhere?
We have that evidence, and some of it has been published. Some of it has been disclosed to international law enforcement who are not necessarily in, shall we say, friendly data exchange positions with our government for a very interesting protective reason. We have a host of this source data and raw data stored in caches across the globe in both physical form and electronic form and a few other kinds of media that we use to store data. And we have that as part of a fairly significant data security and personal security strategy, which makes it very difficult for people to actually find or destroy that information.
Okay.
We have, however, made a lot of the information available as part of inquiries that people have done. What we have found is that the closer they get to the raw data, the bigger the problem occurs, and most people get quite concerned when they see how far up the food chain it goes.
Okay. Along those lines, first of all, are you withholding a certain amount of information in order to keep yourself and the people that you're working with safe? Assuming that you do have, I mean, in other words, I know you've published this novel. It is, well, in theory, a novel and not a nonfiction work. However, you're on you're out there now, at least on this show, and I don't know what your history has been with talking about the book. But in other words, one would assume that if your information is as accurate as you say it is, then you would be receiving, threats of all kinds.
We have not just received them. We've been actively involved in a number of very inhospitable experiences.
Okay. Do you want to elaborate?
Insofar as I will say, as I've said on other interviews, when you live in a world where those who think they control the system know that they are the masters of conspiracy, they have a very difficult time trying to figure out what motivates a person who actually is doing the things that I do without any both visible or proximate benefit for doing it. And one of the very fascinating experiences that I had throughout 2005 and 2006, which I address in part in the book, were experiences where I was subjected to a variety of methods that the various interests had in understanding for whom I worked. Quite ironically, when you say that you actually are working for things like the truth, when you say you're working for things like the betterment of humanity, the individuals who are trying to extract information get very frustrated because they know that can't be true. And so in the wonderful words of a gentleman who is now retired from the Federal Service but was part of one of the intelligence operations in the United States government, he said, what keeps you alive is one day they're going to find out for whom you work, and they're going to keep you alive until they find that out. In the zone of, I find that slightly fascinating, I do, because the fact is that we have always been working for the conspiracy of humanity. And if that is something that they're not familiar with, I suppose they'll last a lifetime trying to figure that out.
Okay, well, considering Project Camelot, I'm very well familiar with that, but I'm not sure that they have quite so much difficulty figuring that out, at least in regard to Camelot. Your situation may be a little different simply because you come at it from the financial end of things. And usually when finance is involved, they assume that you are therefore interested and motivated by money. Right. And that would be your primary motivation as opposed to rather a secondary one. In the case of Camelot, it's a little more blatant what we work for and why. But I'll leave that as it is. Well, okay, this is interesting. I appreciate that you're not going into too much detail, obviously, in what kind of threats you've had. So my sense is that is this character, Dr. Cyrus Alexander, is this some kind of composite of you and other people that you work with?
It is largely a figure that actually gets to see the world that I have seen in first person. And so I would refer to the character in the book as the observer of the events that I observed.
Okay. And when you say events that you observed, because, and again, this whole scenario and the meeting that took place, et cetera, in other words, you're not just following money. You're also getting intelligence, I assume, from well-placed agents. In other words, I don't think you were not at the meeting yourself. So
absolutely was. And I was not only at that meeting, but as you go through the book, there are a significant number of events that you will see in remarkable detail. And that remarkable detail is because I happen to be in the room or at the location. I spend approximately two-thirds of my time traveling all over the world. People familiar with our work know that I spend a significant amount of time in the Asia-Pacific region, a significant amount of my time in Europe, Middle East, North Africa, and Europe. The events in the book are in large part both direct observations and in certain cases, observations made by people who are part of our network.
Okay. Well, then let me ask you this. Obviously you had to be approached by this group that wanted to call Enterprise were being recruited in a sense these higher level people. So you had to be one of those people they were attempting to recruit. Is that how
that
you would term
correct.
It?
And they were interested in recruiting my involvement because of the technology that we have, which actually sources the kinds of information that we've been discussing.
Okay. Let me ask you, are you familiar with Promise Software?
Promise Software, I am not familiar with that particular name.
Okay, Promis. It's supposed to be part. Well, it is part of a software that eventually became part of a database that is a worldwide database at this point. But eventually went was created by a small company in the U.S. that was then stolen from them by the government, by the U.S. government, by a certain portion of that government, which was more associated with black projects than anything else, I think you might say, and also the drug, the DEA and all that. And then they took it. They never reimbursed the small company who created it or initially created it. And then it kind of, I guess, backdoors were put into it. It was augmented as software. It was initially sort of a legal database and then became expanded to profiling humans all over the planet.
Was this the software that was developed by Innslaw?
Yes.
Yeah.
And anyway, so you know Innslaw then, so yep. You must know Promise. Well,
there are a number of names for the software that they developed. So.
Oh, all right. Well, Promise is the extremely well-known name that I've, you know, there's a lot of investigation has been done along these lines. And Danny Castellero is the journalist that was killed. He was suicided, as they call it. And he had done a great deal of work. It's called The Trail of the Octopus is one of the ways it's referred to. And there's a book by that name that talks about it as well. But it sounds as though you say you were tapped because of your software or, you know, that has these capabilities, these kind of database capabilities, it sounds like. That's very interesting. Just out of curiosity, was it because you had a team that developed a certain kind of software, or are you yourself a software programmer or developer?
The actual framing of the platforms that we use are mathematical systems and mathematical models that actually are known only to three people. Those three people actually include myself, but two others. And the way all of the platforms were and are maintained and developed, you actually have to know the three people you have to put in a room at the same time to actually get any of the code to be anything other than essentially an uncrackable code. So there is a means by which we built it, and the individuals who are associated with it individually, with the exception of the person speaking to you right now, do not have the complete code, so there's kind of only one key.
Okay. And are you able to tell us what the capability is of this software?
Yes, it does dynamic fractal database analysis, which allows you to look at very rapid analysis of exceptionally large databases without being constrained by either language or mode of data. So it actually runs on what's called the linguistic genomics algorithm, which I developed back in the late 80s and early 90s. That process allows you to look at both communication signals, financial signals, and what we refer to as intent signals, which actually have to do with whether people are originating messages or propagating messages or transmitting, embedded messages. Those are all things that we do, and we have used it, and you can go into the very public record of our use. It has been used by the United States Treasury Department for tax fraud investigation. It's been used by a number of congressionally authorized programs to actually audit government operations that Congress has sought to audit. So it has been used in a number of environments, and we have a very, very strict policy on limiting the types of projects for which it can be used.
Okay, well, very interesting. Let's see. I have a number of directions I want to go. One of the questions I have in reading the book is this idea that you say that young sort of hackers or programmers were given the task, sort of a blind task, of driving the non-manned vehicles into the trade center.
Correct.
And that they didn't necessarily know that they were going to be actually doing that. They thought this was a sort of a test or whatever. And that they were as young as 13 years old. Do you have substantial backup for that information?
There are a number of processes that have been deployed throughout the last several years, largely in the gaming and simulation environments, which have had to do with the ability to have individuals who think they are involved in gaming scenarios actually have the game essentially serve a dual purpose, where the underlying executable code is used both in a scenario simulation environment where the scenario can go live in real time. That is something that is part and parcel of a number of both training environments as well as actual defense-related environments. And the birth of the remote kill-operated unmanned vehicles is something that has been a technology area that we have become exceptionally aware of in terms of both the operators and the individuals involved and the capabilities of those systems, both on the North American side of the Pacific, as well as on what's happening currently on the Asia side of the Pacific, are staggering beyond your wildest imagination. And I'm sure you have a wild imagination.
Well, yes, but I also get a lot of information. And I don't know, do you happen to have any time to look at Camelot?
I have.
There, this is Carrie Cassidy, Project Camelot, Whistleblower Radio, and we're talking to David E. Martin about his new book called The Apostles of Power, Theft of an Empire, also known at one point as Coup de 12. And David, are you still there?
I am indeed.
Okay, very good. Let's see, we were talking right before the break about, about teams of what you called gamers who are being given sort of scenarios and then, I guess, troubleshooting possible outcomes and not knowing whether or not that they are actually gaming in reality and basically in some cases being used by the military on sort of missions that they may or may not know all the parameters, and that in fact they were used in to pilot the planes virtually, so to speak, I assume, on the Trade Center situation. Is that correct? That's your information.
The information is that the ability to command and control, and it is not unique to aircraft. It is actually the case with several other very significant means of both public transportation and other forms of mobile unmanned devices. The ability to go from simulation to live weaponization is something that, as you well know, has been perfected. In fact, the current administration has actually perfected the art of the remote kill to a layer that very few people ever imagined, certainly those people who thought they were getting something different than they got would have ever imagined. And the fact is that there is an enormous number of situations where those things which are reported to be mechanical failures, pilot error, accidents, and other forms of disruptions are in fact not disruptions in the classic sense. They are actually intentional disruptions, and that is the case in a number of incidents.
Okay.
9/11.
Okay, that's cool. First of all, we could go into the 9/11 situation to some degree, but you've now sort of triggered another question that I have. because you're kind of alluding to, I know that there was, there was the thing with the missiles in North Dakota, the Minot missile crisis.
Minot, yes,
yes,
North Dakota.
Minot. Yeah. Okay. And I'm wondering whether you have any information in that regard, as you're saying, if because this is the very kind of thing where they were basically put onto a plane. The plane was sent out, at least on one of the missions, and I'm not sure if it's exactly this one, and it actually turned back. It was turned back, supposedly interfered with. We were told that the Chinese possibly were hacking into the system and messing with it, but it's also possible that it was overridden, again, long distance, the way you're talking about it.
Well, most of the events that took place in the air on September 11th, 2001 had a significant amount of command and control that was taking place well outside of the cockpits of individual planes. And so there are isolated events that have drawn attention. There are a number of other events that should draw attention that have not, not the least of which is the sudden ability for the remote tracking of aircraft to be so immediately available, where prior to the actual event that was not available. A whole host of things, which, as you know, the clearing of the airspace became something of a particularly interesting scenario, given the fact that, you know, on a normal summer day, you can't clear airspace over Chicago or Newark for hours. And somehow or another, it gets mysteriously cleared without any significant problem. Those are things that actually bear a great deal more inquiry. And the further you go into it and the more you see who the contractors are that are involved in those both command and control systems and who are involved in the actual management of air traffic infrastructure, the deeper you go into that inquiry, the more very fascinating information you find, which is one of the things that we think is of great importance as people actually ask and seek to answer the questions that are plaguing a lot of the unfilled components of the stories that we've been told are the stories that actually happened.
Okay, so, but you're not addressing the Minot situation at this time. Do you have anything to say about that?
Yeah, one of the things that I don't do is I actually try to awaken people to the fact that the stories that are drawing public attention, I've made this point before, are actually in many instances stories that are distracting people from other stories. And the other stories are where the larger events are unfolding. We do have some information with respect to Minot, North Dakota, but the folks up in Minot actually are used to using the T. Minot, North Dakota is a place that has an enormous amount of air command and control systems, but it also, you know, you can also look at what happened out of Colorado on the same day. You can look at what happened out of Madigan on the same day. You can look at what happened out of Texas on the same day. And all of those stories are equally important. So I'm not trying to deflect,
okay,
calling attention to the fact that individual stories are missing a much broader point, which is there is a much, much larger series of actions that are going on. And what we do in our organization and what we have done historically and what I do personally is to make sure that we focus on the fact that there is smoke and there is fire, and then there is actually the people with matches and lighter fluid, and we're focused on them.
Okay. Yeah, and I appreciate that. Okay, well, thank you for that. A few more questions here. And we do have people that are asking. We have a chat room that goes along with the show.
Sure.
In fact, we have two chat rooms and we have a call-in line as well. So people may we may open the lines here in a few minutes for people to call in if you don't mind.
Oh, cool. That's great.
Okay. And I continue to have more questions for you in light of all the things you're saying, obviously. So what I'm wondering at this point is, are you familiar with the idea that there is a network of satellites, nanosatellites, and also that they are run by a group, a sort of massive sort of satellite called Mother, that are also command and control centers, as if you will, and are the use of those. And I wonder if there's a sort of that the programmers are actually using the satellites or sending their information through to those nanosatellites that are then downloading the information to the mainframes or, you know, to the planes or wherever it happens to go.
You will be delighted to read the last chapter of the book.
Okay.
It turns out that I go very much into detail on the satellite and the role of the satellites that are going on actually as we speak, as well as the very interesting EMF hardening that's going on associated with some of those satellite operations, which, once again, I don't want to be a spoiler, but it's worth reading the end of the book to answer that question. Yes, very familiar. And
okay.
I can actually list a couple ITU registries as part of a novel that may be interesting to look at.
Excellent. Okay. And may I recommend, if you haven't already heard my, I have a couple of interviews with Anthony Sanchez, who has had death threats because of the Lockheed Martin whistleblowers who have given him information about this network of nanosatellites. You'll be very interested.
Delighted to see that. But I'm sure that you will find that there's a, there are a number of interesting parties involved in the Cobra space array that is currently operational.
Okay. Well, that's a loaded statement. all right.
Yeah, you'll find that that's actually part of the rather interesting set of issues that we deal with respect to why it's important, because it's important as part of some of the last operating components of the enterprise.
Okay. Well, I appreciate that for the purposes of the book on the one hand, but in terms of our discussion here, because of our listening audience, some of whom may or may not read the book, and there are, you know, I mean, there are some obvious link-ups in the information that I'm getting from you at this time, you know, now literally in real time, so to speak, and where Camelot has gone and has been and other information we've gotten. And I'm wondering if you know what the terminology crypto-terrestrial means.
Well, there are actually a couple. There is a store forward process, which is something that was put in place after the interruption of the Trans-Pacific cables, which you'll recall back several years ago took place involving the communications links to Singapore and Hong Kong and a number of other places, where a variable set of satellites became used both in their on and in their switch off phase, because, as you know, satellites go in from light and dark activity. There were a series of satellites that actually became means by which there are both backup storage and backup deletion routines that can be done on both terrestrial and non-terrestrial storage units that are part of the broader satellite terrestrial network. And a lot of the information with respect to how that infrastructure works involves a variety of very fascinating data management and data encryption processes. So there are a host of those issues that have become increasingly complicated given the fact that a number of the people who originally worked on those projects were actually graduate students in the United States who have gone back to various home countries that have become very actively involved in that. So there are an array, once again, that's a family of things, not just a single thing.
Okay. But in terms of, I mean, now we're kind of in the land of Stuxnet as well. And what I want to ask you is, see, with the information that you seem to have, you may have also been tracking what actually went on with regard to Fukushima, for example, to the Indonesian, tsunami, and how things were triggered using satellites and so on. And so there, that's one aspect. And then the other aspect is, of course, the use of HAARP and you know, and all of that, and weather wars, and et cetera, et cetera. So, I mean, in other words, if you have a software that can sort of do some of the things that it sounds like it can do, then you're able to mass a great deal of information. And then it sounds like, and tell me if I'm wrong, but it sounds like maybe it does some degree of distilling information, like
yes,
large amounts.
It does a great deal of distilling information. Part of what you'll see when we talk about a couple of the very interesting events that are detailed in the book have to do with looking at things like the interaction between satellite communications and service disruptions, the terrestrial systems. You mentioned HAARP, which is an interesting arena, particularly when you look at power consumption and the arrays that are not just in Alaska and the places that people are familiar with, but they also are in a few other locations, which one of which I describe in detail in the book. But a lot of these things actually are synergistic systems, so that there are both terrestrial and orbital command and transfer centers. And one of the things that becomes very fascinating is looking at the actual power utilization information that has to do with the events that you've described. Particularly our most fascinating set of events is the reason, and one of the reasons why we got very, very actively interested in a number of these issues is because for some inexplicable reason, large-scale geologic activity seemed to be co-locating with nuclear facilities in a remarkable correlation, including, mind you, the earthquake that I refer to in the book with respect to the Lake Anna nuclear facility here in Virginia. But as you know, the earthquake in southern China, the earthquake in Japan, the earthquake in a number of locations, which happened to all have similar magnitudes and all happened to have similar effects on nuclear facilities. Those are issues that led us to look at a number of both power utilization and power supply curves that took place in regions where both HAARP as well as orbital emissions technologies are being deployed. And that's part of what we looked at in great detail. In fact, that's something that is the subject of an ongoing inquiry that we're in the midst of at the moment.
Okay. And when you say emission technologies, are you talking about EMP waves or particle beam weapons, things along those lines?
As you know, the military for the last several years has enjoyed a near limitless budget with respect to EMF and EMP hardening. One of the things that we find very fascinating is that issue seems to have gone under the kind of the, once again, missed in plain sight appropriator lenses of any form of public media. The fact of the matter is we were extremely comfortable for quite a long time in the United States that we had the kind of best state of the art EMP and EMF capabilities, both in terms of the emitters as well as the hardening technologies. What was revealed in a published report from the Department of Defense, very, very interestingly, is the fact that we in fact are now deeply concerned officially that electromagnetic spectrum technologies in parts of Asia and in a number of other locations around the world are actually far superior to what we actually originally thought. And what's particularly interesting with respect to the EMP and EMF hardening issues is that the official studies that have been outstanding were originally focused as a kind of legacy of the Cold War, where people thought that there would be a low-altitude nuclear device, which would lead to kind of some of the more concerning EMP and EMF events. Now we realize that there are a number of satellites which have great capabilities for both EMP as well as a variety of other wavelengths of the electromagnetic spectrum and the acoustical spectrum, which create extremely significant threats, one of which is very actively part of the Enterprise conspiracy, which has to do with the selective eradication of electronic financial records, which I detail in considerable detail.
Oh, okay. Very interesting. Yeah, that's absolutely fascinating. Well, let me, you know, your book, when did you stop reading? When did you, you know, when finish your book, so to speak?
The book actually took 7 weeks to write from start to finish.
Okay.
I actually concluded writing it in May of 2011 and kind of put it on the shelf. And then a group of people got together in the latter part of the summer, and there was a conversation about the book and the fact that I had written it. A number of people who had read it, a lot of friends who had asked for copies because they knew I had written it. Two individuals asked me whether the events of the last two chapters actually had happened or were about to happen. It turned out that that we were kind of coming up on the latter part of the summer, and I talked about the fact that there were going to be a series of financial transactions that were part of what I wrote about in the book that were likely going to be taking place in the next several weeks. We decided to go ahead and e-publish the book, which is where the coup de 12 title came from, which we thought was a great title because it kind of played off of the coup d'etat that was the, you know, the corporatization takeover.
Yes.
of the government. And we decided to e-release the book, which we did. And lo and behold, right when that decision was made, within about 3 days, we had the earthquake that you're aware of that took place in Virginia, where we are known to have tons of earthquakes, as everybody knows. which led to the shutdown of the nuclear power plant, which is exactly what we had put in the book.
And very interesting.
That's how the book went from being an interesting, somewhat prescient thing to a lot of people going, hold on a second, you actually wrote a book about an event that that actually is happening as we're reading the book. And that's
very interesting.
That's where it got kind of fascinating.
Yeah, no doubt about it. Well, again, you know, I want people listening to read the book, and it sounds like we're getting some feedback on the line here. I don't know if that means we've got a caller on the line. Do we have a caller on the line? Is that why there's some feedback?
No, ma'am. It was coming from you.
It's very interesting. I'm alone here, to my knowledge, but you never know with all the technology that's. I'm sure there's some people that are very interested in what we're having to say here. Okay, well, what I wanted to say was because, you know, there is a great deal going on right now. And so you seem to have been tapped and gotten special access up to this point. And then I'm assuming that special sort of access or whatever has continued to a point, although it seems to me that once you released your book and people, you know, that they would have been been less favorable towards you or towards giving you access to information. It seems like at some point there would be efforts to shut that down around you. But assuming that you're still getting some kind of access, and certainly if you have this software you're talking about, which also, I have to ask you if you know who Cliff High is and whether you've been following his webbot at all.
I have not followed his webbot, no.
Okay. Because he has a sort of a, It doesn't sound quite the same kind of software that you have, but there might be some parallels. But at any rate, he decided to turn that into sort of a predictive kind of quasi-predictive software. In other words, if you have a software that can distill databases down to to specifics and then cross-correlate them and also put in percentages of like likelihood of those things happening, then you end up with a predictable software or a software that it tries to predict the future. But in your case, it sounds like you analyze what you have at hand. What my question is, I'm sorry to be so convoluted here, is that I want to know whether or not you're looking at the current state of affairs, financially and otherwise, and certainly the LIBOR situation is very hot right now, although apparently that came to the fore. Even though it's hot right now, from what I understand, it actually came to the fore a couple of years ago. And maybe you can address. So what I'm asking you to do here is to talk about right now, as opposed to the book at this
point. Well, some of your listeners will probably already be familiar with, and some of them won't be. I maintain a weekly blog, Inverted Alchemy, and on that blog, we address issues that are immediate at hand. I also make a number of public appearances on some fairly mainstream media, so people can find out the fact that we make very active commentary on corporate situations where people are misleading public with respect to their public statements. And
welcome back, folks. The Whistleblower Radio with Kerry Cassidy and our guest, David Martin. Kerry, are you back?
Hi, this is Kerry Cassidy. Sorry.
That's all right.
Okay, I had to let my cat out. So at any rate, David, I'd love to hear the rest of your answer, if you recall the question.
You bet. The current financial situation, as most of your listeners will be aware, is actually somewhat comedy, if you can kind of take a step back far enough. The basic premise of what's going on right now is that the purveyors of the system who actually have all of their credibility riding on the illusion that has been kind of the legacy of the Bretton Woods Agreement and all of the formation of the kind of dollar hegemony of the last 60 years are pulling on levers rather madly and being quite frustrated by the fact that the old levers don't seem to be having the effect anymore. And so an enormous amount of what we are told is the cause for panic is actually really not cause for panic. In fact, it is just the passage of a system that, quite frankly, wasn't working out very well for the majority of humanity on the planet. And the fact is that system is failing. It was an experiment, and it was an experiment that has not worked out very well. One of the things that we look at, however, is that as in any transition, there are going to be significant shocks in the system, which are largely created by the illusion of media rather than true shocks. The fact of the matter is that desperation and the byproducts of fear are things that are fairly easily sold to the general population. But the fact of the matter is that an awful lot of what is falling apart wasn't really there. One of the points that I made years ago was when we realized that the derivatives market actually exceeded the global GDP by at least a factor of one, possibly a factor of two at its peak, you realize that, 10 times bets against humanity, which were what credit default swaps actually are, suggests that the majority of people are betting against humanity. Now, the fact of the matter is, if those bets turn out to be wrong, actually, we're all the better for it. So when we hear about CDS collapse, I actually don't hang my head. I think that it's phenomenal that you actually have people losing the bets that they placed against humanity. And that's the case with a lot of these instruments, where people don't get into the weeds of what is actually behind the economics. The fact of the matter is, the most important piece of financial news that took place probably in the last 6 months is something that was barely reported in any Western media, and that was the agreement that exists now between Japan and China, and the agreement that exists between China and India, and now a rather large consortium in the Asia-Pacific region, where essentially what I had forecast back at a speech I gave at Notre Dame several years ago is actually coming true, and that is that the rest of the world has decided that the hegemony of the dollar has largely come to an end, and they're now starting to live in a world where they are not relying on the U.S. dollar or the euro to actually transact business. We don't have, in most American and most European financial minds, a willingness to accept that somebody may one day just say, sorry, you're not interesting enough for us to concern ourselves with. And so we're trying desperately to prop up the illusion of control. One of the things I try to do on Inverted Alchemy is bring the public's attention to the story behind the story, which actually helps diffuse the myth that we are somehow in this near apocalyptic crisis where the world's going to come to a crashing end. And the fact of the matter is, the world of information asymmetries and the world where people get to take advantage of those information asymmetries for their self-enrichment is a world that is in fact coming to an end. And my statement there is, great, let it end. Because there's an enormous part of the world that has been marginalized and sidelined. A lot of the work we do around the world has to do with bringing light into those situations and bringing visibility into those situations. And so when I hear about all the hand-wringing about the end of times with respect to the financial situation, I actually sit back and kind of go, you know, it's really not the fire drill that everybody wants to make it out to be. As a matter of fact, there's an outside chance that humanity may get a chance for the first time in a long time to actually play a role in framing something new that actually works for a lot larger number of people around the world. So that's the reason why we have such an active education initiative that we do through both the company, but also through the Inverted Alchemy blog.
Okay. Well said. And I actually happen to agree with you on that. Let's see. In terms of Inverted Alchemy, as you call it, is this not on MCAM? Is this another URL?
Yeah, Inverted Alchemy is a blog that I maintain. Actually, it has a beautiful legacy. When I was on the board of the Arlington Institute, which was a futurist think tank for whom I was on the board for several years, we hosted a thing called Springside Chats, which was essentially a multi-hour conversation where we would talk. I would talk about the kind of the global geopolitical and geoeconomic condition. And people from around the world would come and spend several hours listening to the perspectives that I had. A lot of this came up to and then expanded quite considerably after my 2006 speech where I had forecast the collapse of the banking system. And one of the dear friends and colleagues who were part of the Arlington Institute asked me to start writing a blog. The term Inverted Alchemy actually came from another collaboration I did with another friend up in New York who was working on bringing some visibility to the current international slave trade, which is quite robust in a number of industries. My biggest issue where I've been focused on international slave issues is in the minerals and extractive industries space. He was interested in a number of other areas of human trafficking. We got together and we discussed the irony that the only thing that humanity has ever figured out how to turn into gold is human blood. And wouldn't it be cool if we actually figured out a way to turn gold back into humanity? So Inverted Alchemy was born of that impulse, which is the idea of taking that kind of occult and very mythic impulse that says that we should be able to take things and turn them into gold. We actually rather like the idea of taking gold and turning it back into the earth and the ground and people and quality of life and all the things that gold has cost. So that's where Inverted Alchemy was born. And it is a weekly promise that I'm keeping to a dear old friend who asked me to write a blog once a week so he could still hear my thoughts.
Okay, excellent. Let me ask you whether or not you know or have a point of view of the situation with regard to, one, the global, what are called the global settlements, and this is something the White Hats talk about, and there is an article on my blog on the front page of Camelot today that links to their blog. But at any rate, they are often referring to what they call the global settlements, and that's money owed. And then also with regard to the revaluing of currency, specifically the Iraqi dinar, have you followed any of those things?
Yeah, well, I think it's important to go back a little bit. Yes, I've been looking at those issues, but we have to go back in time a little bit. If you go back to the original framework that was put in place all the way back as part of the Bretton Woods Accords, which led to a fairly interesting series of transactions that were set up kind of in the hope that the U.S. dollar would actually achieve its hegemony, but with the realization that at the time Bretton Woods happened, the Deutsche Mark was still much stronger currency than anything else. There were a number of agreements made with respect to how currency valuation would be set and how currency valuations would be transacted. The thing that I think a lot of listeners need to go back and look at is actually something that that takes place as part of Bretton Woods, and that is the creation of the IMF and the World Bank's SDRs, which are the synthetic drawing rights, or kind of these apolitical and detached from or uncorrelated to any particular currency transactions, which become a means of any country to decide to move out of currencies into what are called SDRs. SDRs include a variety of optional currency offsets and transactions. And when you look at the World Global Settlement Funds and a number of the other initiatives that are going on to allegedly transfer significant amounts of wealth around the world, once again, the Iraqi dinar revaluation is one of a number, but it is only one of a number of situations where people are actually trying to do two things. One is to uncouple holdings from the current draw facilities that are alleged to be draw obligations against the U.S. Treasury, the Federal Reserve, and other things. But what's interesting is, in addition to that, a number of places are starting to link these to actual relinkages of currencies back to the claim to either energy or metals in a variety of parts of the world. And so there are a number of interests that are happening where, once again, the kind of the World Global Settlement Funds is one of, but not the only one of, these kind of efforts to both draw on reserves as well as relink financial obligations primarily back into resource-rich and economically disadvantaged countries.
Okay, but given what they are, and knowing what you know about the power structure behind the scenes here, assuming, because I haven't finished your book, but assuming that you do know a great deal about the power structure on planet Earth at this given time, then where do you think these things stand? And as part of that, another corollary to that, and I'm sorry to be going through all this, but we have such a limited amount of time here, and I need to get, I know people will want to hear your answers to these questions, certain people very seriously. In regard to, I don't know if you're familiar with the Keenan lawsuit that was put forward that has to do. It's another sort of attempt. This in the case of the basically the Indonesians to What they initially wanted was to get to become part of what is called a trading program. And I'm the last part of that question is, are you familiar with the trading programs, where the money goes, and so on?
Well, what I'm aware of with respect to some of those issues has to do with the information that has been released with respect to an issue that I do speak about quite a bit in terms of the link of both Tim Geithner and Hillary Clinton's frequent trips together to China. I have been following those issues actually quite significantly. And what you'll find, and I address this at length in the book, is that part of what's going on is the Chinese government and several other governments have decided that there is a great deal of interest in moving off of the dollar hegemony and the relative kind of illusion created by the current Fed system and move into more of a resource and GDP or productivity linked based currency. And there has been an enormous effort by the part of many interests in the United States to actually impair that process. What you'll find is that if you look at the work of, you know, Tim Turner and some of the others, Keith Scott is a name that you'll hear encountered from time to time, who are looking into a lot of these issues, what they need to do is look at a very significant number of resource development issues that took place about a decade ago, both in China and Inner Mongolia and parts of Central Asia, where the underlying issues surrounding the question of what's happening on a number of these currency manipulation efforts becomes really relevant, because what's happening is that a number of countries are actually suggesting that they're going to move entirely off of any call options against the U.S. Treasury or any of the other types of currency obligations established by the U.S. government or its affiliates, and move on to a new standard, which is kind of the bigger picture inside of what's going on inside of both the Keenan lawsuit and other initiatives that are happening initiated outside of the U.S.
Okay, but given, you know, regardless of what they're attempting to do, again, I'm asking you, in terms of the power structure that you are familiar with, what do you think the chances are that those sort of efforts will succeed?
Well, I think that what's going to happen is that this is kind of the broader thesis that I not only endorse, but I live. And that is that certain systems, and the current system is one of them, are human experiments that actually have a operational life, and then they have a operational death. We are in the death phase of a particular system, and we are at the stage where we're given the opportunity to rebirth a new system. What you'll find is that a number of the initiatives that are going on right now with respect to trying to move large amounts, whether it's, you know, 45 trillion, whether it's 60 trillion, depending on who you're looking at, various people like to refer to all kinds of numbers. The fact of the matter is we are going to be moving away from a debt-denominated system, which enslaves humanity, into a productivity-linked system, because that is actually the only thing that will ultimately have sustainability around it. That said, I don't know if you're familiar with the beautiful scene in the movie 300, where you have that great scene of the war rhino, which is charging and is about to what appears to run into the 300 guarding Hell's Gates. And you have this beautiful scene where the spear is thrown into the head of a war rhinoceros, and oddly enough, the spear goes into his head, but the war rhinoceros continues to run forward and run forward and run forward, and everybody's breathless. And you see the warrior standing unmovable and not moving his ground as the war rhinoceros comes towards him. And what happens is, right as the war rhinoceros is about to hit the warrior, it grinds its nose into the ground and it's dead. And the point of this is that the death of the system, that we're currently talking about has already happened. There is a number of momentum and inertia elements that keep the illusion of it moving forward, making people think, oh, it's still here. But the fact of the matter is, we're living in a time when the system that is has already failed. And we're now living in a time where there is a great opportunity for all of us to be part of saying that system is broken. Now what we're going to do is, rather than fearing the Battle of Thermopylae, what we're actually going to be doing is moving forward and saying, what does the new look like? How do we make sure that we stand in our confidence that that thing that is new, that opportunity that is new, is something which is informed by the past, that does all of the things that, you know, it can do to help structure a better humanity, and ultimately, you know, standing the ground like Leonidas did at Thermopylae, you know, the hordes of Persians against the 300 at the gates. What we need to be doing is we need to be realizing that, like anything else, the giant lumbering machine called the current system, spear in its head and all, is going to fail, and there is going to be something new that comes of it.
And okay, but given, okay, and I appreciate that, and very well said and very poetically said. However, given the situation, you're writing a book about the buying of the presidency by a group of very, well, it appears, first of all, sort of an entrepreneurial group of, yep, of high rollers who are then enlisted to make this thing happen. But they're controllers behind the scenes, which are probably a lot more interesting. And I haven't gotten to that part of your book, so I don't know where you're going to go with all of it. But I can at least surmise that you are still looking at a situation, and we are looking at a situation, regardless of how dead the system is. And I agree with you wholeheartedly, especially on the economic level, but on many other levels as well. It is quite dead and has been for quite some time. However, it continues to sort of roll on, this machine, you know, even though it's out of gas, so to speak. And right, and we have an election coming up, you know, I guess in this fall. It seems ludicrous to me. And there's a, you know, this individual Romney, who's very much a part of the system, and, you know, very jaded and questionable on all levels, and working very closely with Bush Sr., who is orchestrating a lot of things behind the scenes, from what I understand. Mm-hmm. And, you know, how, you know, and I know we have 5 minutes left, and I haven't even been able to let people ask you questions other than myself, but I'm sorry about that. It's just that this is, you know, it's fascinating to hear your level of access, so to speak. And so what do you have to say about that, about the upcoming election, in light of the book you've written?
Well, interestingly enough, we are actually at the stage now where one of the things that's important to point out about the book is that the shareholders that actually bought 2008. Actually got more than they bargained for. They had an easier time achieving the wealth transfer than they thought they would have. Quite ironically, as I say in the back cover of the book, a lot of the people who the Kenan lawsuit names, for example, the kind of the classic alleged parties that are kind of always in everybody's list of the global elite. Oddly enough, a lot of them were swindled too. So there's kind of a comic irony that these groups of entrepreneurs wound up doing a phenomenal job of even fleecing the fleecers. That for me is somewhat comedy, because I like to know that, you know, that the criminals actually wind up ultimately stealing from themselves. There is some attractiveness to that. What ultimately happens, however, is things like the Kenan lawsuit, things like other efforts to try to unveil who's behind the thing, for me, is kind of like driving through the rearview mirror. I'm not saying that it doesn't have its merit, and I'm not saying it doesn't have its value. What I am saying is that it's extremely important that we work on ways to make sure that the public understands that kind of all of it has been rendered irrelevant. And now we're really in a time where we, the people, need to start standing up and saying that a future system needs to have greater transparency, needs to have greater linkages to humanity, and that the old incumbent systems, whether it is the incumbent systems of the kind of the classic Rothschild piece, or whether it is more of an independent group of entrepreneurs, we need to be in a situation of saying neither one of them is entitled to control our destiny. We actually are going to do it ourselves. And that's something that we, in fact, have been very successfully executing around the world, and we continue to do it. So I'm very hopeful. I think there's a great opportunity in front of us. And I think your show and shows like this are ways to get people kind of off of the ledge of crisis mode and into the ledge of active mode, which says, let's actually start building something that we all recognize as human.
Okay. Just a side note, I have had discussions with Keith Scott. So I do know some things about that, the background there, but it is an interesting, one of the things also is that the White Hats, and are you familiar with that? The Dark Cabal blogspot.com, I believe is their URL.
Yeah, I think I've seen that on a couple of occasions. It was referred in a previous interview.
Okay. Well, at any rate, one of the things that they're trying to do is obviously, you know, deal with the global settlements. But beyond that, there's the issue of the gold. What they say is the gold. Now, you're saying productivity-based. I'm not sure whether you're suggesting going off the gold. You know, in other words, there's this big issue of the gold in the Philippines or the gold that is around the world in hidden, actually.
Yes.
And whether it would be backing the currency if one went into a new system or not.
Well, there's no question, and you'll see this in the book, that there is a gold standard being formed right now. I go into considerable detail about who's actually architecting the new gold standard. And that's something that we're actually very actively intermediating from the standpoint of spoiling certain ones of those plans right now.
Okay. Well, it sounds like I definitely need to hear more from you. And I know people are going to be very frustrated. I want to apologize to everyone that we couldn't get your questions besides my questions. I really